Good afternoon. I'm Kate Manahan. Thank you for listening to What Mama Wants. I think Mother Earth wants far less toxics and more health for her planet. This is a chance to hear from educators, citizens, policymakers, and scientists about the role toxics like mercury, PFAS, and pesticides are playing in our daily lives. My guest today is biologist Dr. Diane Kopek. She is the research fellow at the Senator George J. Mitchell Center for Sustainability at the University of Maine in Orono. Much of her research is related to how fish polluted by mercury impact those who eat them, humans and animals alike. Diane, thank you so much for joining me today on What Mama Wants.
It's my pleasure, Kate. Thanks for asking me to speak.
I love talking to scientists.
Well, I think scientists like to talk about their work. So that's an excellent blend we have here.
Peanut butter and chocolate. So I wondered if we could start with the element mercury. We extract it and use it and release it into the environment, and then it acts as a neurotoxin in the bodies that eventually absorb it. How does mercury get into the environment? Where does it come from? Why are we exposed to it?
Well, there are two sources of mercury to the environment. One is natural. It's released when volcanoes erupt or when certain rock formations erode. And it's also released because humans have found industrial uses for mercury. Right now, we have over 3 times more mercury in our environment than we would naturally. And ways that it can be released currently include coal-fired power plants. Mercury is a contaminant in coal. And when you burn coal to produce energy, the mercury is released into the atmosphere. And it's released in 2 forms. One is inorganic mercury, which has a positive charge on it. And that positive charge is really important because it allows the mercury to be water soluble. So that inorganic mercury that is spewed up into the air can be absorbed by raindrops and fall back to Earth. Or it can adhere to particles of dust in the air and come back down to the Earth as dry deposition. That usually happens close to the source. But about half the mercury released when coal is burned goes up into the atmosphere as elemental mercury. And that's a neutral particle. It just bounces around in the atmosphere and can be carried on our upper level winds for up to a year. So it can circle the globe. And eventually, that elemental mercury will get zapped by a photon of sunlight. It'll lose an electron and it'll have a different charge. And then it'll be water soluble and fall back to Earth again. So mercury can enter the atmosphere through the air, either close to the source or tens to thousands of miles away from the original source. And mercury is also discharged into our environment through discharges to our rivers and our lakes. Here in Maine, we had a concentrated mercury source on the lower Penobscot River with the Holtrachem chloralkali plant. That plant went into production in 1967. And operated until 2000. Those years are really important because in the early years when that plant was operating, there was no Clean Water Act. There were some regulations trying to get a handle on water pollution, but there wasn't the overall standards across the country defining what was safe to put into our surface waters and what wasn't. So mercury, liquid mercury, that had been contaminated with the chemicals used in that industrial operation at Holtrachem were dumped into the Penobscot River. It's estimated that between 6 to 12 tons of mercury entered the river over the time of the plant. That's a lot of mercury.
Wow.
So there can be point sources like that, and then there can be general sources to the atmosphere. Once mercury falls to Earth, it's an element. It's an essential building block of our Earth. It's not destroyed. It just gets moved around in the environment. And when it's water soluble, it gets carried on surface water to streams and then into our lakes and eventually into the ocean. But it mercury that enters the water and falls down into the sediment, that's the mud on the bottom of our rivers and our lakes, can be methylated. A methyl group is a carbon with three hydrogens attached to it. That methyl mercury is really insidious because it looks similar to neutral amino acids. So once it enters the food web, at the very base of the food web in the plants, organisms that eat the plants that have the methylmercury in them can't get rid of it. The amino acids are useful for all living organisms, and our bodies have evolved to retain amino acids because they may be hard to get down the road. So because methylmercury molecules look, you know, about the same size and conformation as neutral amino acids, they keep being reabsorbed by the body. So they build up in an organism over time. And when a predator eats a prey, the mercury in their prey is incorporated into their body, and then it's passed up the food web. That's what biomagnification is, the increase of a contaminant as you move up different levels of the food web. Fish live in the aquatic environment, naturally, because they have gills, and their food web is longer than some terrestrial food webs. So there's more time for mercury to accumulate until it gets up into the fish. And then humans eat fish, harbor seals eat fish. There are a lot of fish-eating birds, loons, other waterfowl. And they can accumulate really harmful levels of mercury in their system.
What happens to an animal that has had too much exposure to mercury?
There have been numerous studies that have shown reduced reproduction in birds that have been exposed to too much mercury. We found this down on Mendel Marsh, one of the marshes in the lower Penobscot that was contaminated and still is contaminated with mercury from the Holtrachem plant. And we found the highest levels of mercury in the blood of breeding marsh birds that have been reported anywhere in the world, right in that marsh. So mercury has effects on reproduction, the ability of birds to fledge, and this effects on reproduction is ubiquitous throughout different organisms. In humans, methylmercury is a known neurotoxin. It affects the neurodevelopment of fetuses, babies in the womb. And this is why there are health advisories right now in Maine and across the U.S. to limit the consumption of freshwater fish that have been found to have levels of mercury contamination that are harmful to young children and developing fetuses.
The Maine Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife's website actually has a mercury in fish guideline on it. And I wanted to share that with people because I'm not sure everybody swings by the Inland Fisheries and Wildlife website that often. It says, mercury in Maine freshwater fish may harm the babies of pregnant and nursing mothers and young children. Pregnant and nursing women and women who may get pregnant and children under 8 should not eat any freshwater fish from Maine's inland waters, except for brook trout and landlocked salmon, one meal per month is safe. Other adults and older children can have 2 freshwater fish meals a month, or if it happens to be brook trout or landlocked salmon. And Diane, as a PhD research biologist, you've studied mercury in fish. Could you tell us about how this 29-year fish consumption health advisory in Maine came into play and why it's still in place?
The federal government has been working to reduce toxics emissions since the early 1970s with the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act. But initially, the power and coal generation industry was exempt from the Clean Air Act. And it wasn't, yeah, I know, go figure. So they had a very strong lobby saying that they needed to produce the power to run our economy. So it wasn't until around 2012 that we got the mercury and air toxic standards into place and were able to reduce the emissions of mercury and other contaminants from power plants. And that rule was initially really effective and has reduced mercury emissions in our country from that source by over 80%, which is really great.
It's thrilling, actually. We never hear that little piece of news. Like, if we do something about it, it works pretty good.
It does work out. And there have been studies that have shown that when the deposition of mercury from the air is reduced, you find that reduction in mercury in the fish in that watershed. So that we reduce the air emissions, we're going to reduce the levels of mercury in our fish. And just yesterday, the EPA announced a further tightening of the mercury and air toxic standards to further reduce mercury and other harmful contaminants. So this is a big step, and this is the biggest potential reduction in mercury sources in, what, 20 years, something like that, 15 years? It's a big step forward.
It's a big step forward, and I'm pretty curious how a wildlife biologist celebrates news that we're getting results.
Well, isn't that the goal? I mean, we're all living here on the earth, those of us who are concerned about the environment, which I really think includes the vast majority of people. You know, we want a clean home. We want a clean environment. So that's really good news.
My dad always said, celebration's the other half of expectation. And I think in the environmental world, we often have more that we want to do, more that's needed. And I'm all for a little celebration here and there to keep us going.
Yeah. Well, you know, I really appreciate you reading the fish consumption advisory, because I think a lot of folks aren't really aware of that. I became aware of this, oh, about 4 years ago. I was working down at a local fishway monitoring alewives that were coming into a nearby lake. And a fisherman pulled up next to the dam where the fishway is, and he started dip netting for the alewives, which is, you know, totally legal to do. And we got talking, and he says, oh, you want to see the fish I caught here in this stream? A 43-inch pike. And he shows me the picture, and this massive fish is kind of hanging over either side of his arms and sagging in the middle. It's a big, big fish. And I'm looking at that fish, and I'm aware of the mercury levels that can accumulate in larger, older fish. So I said, so do you eat the fish that you catch? He says, oh, yeah, yeah. This one, we got a number of meals out of this one fish. I said, oh, okay. Are you aware of the potential mercury contamination in fish of this size? And he says, no, not really. And so I told him about it and told him about the consumption advisories and that it really was not healthy for pregnant women or young children to eat freshwater fish because of the mercury contamination. And his wife was sitting in the cab of the pickup nearby, and she's listening to us talk. And she calls over and she says, you know, our daughter-in-law ate that fish. We had her over for dinner. She was pregnant. And I'm thinking, oh, shoot. These folks had no clue what was going on. So I started talking with folks in the state and learned that the state has put out a really informative brochure talking about the potential harm from eating freshwater fish, but contrasting that with the value of eating fish. Because fish are high in omega-3 fatty acids and other nutrients that are really good for a developing fetus. So you have to be very careful and choose fish that are low in mercury, but high in these omega-3 fatty acids. Anyway, they hand out information to women in gynecologist's office who are pregnant. But as I thought about it more, I thought, well, so most of the pregnant women know about the potential problem with mercury, but does the general population know about that? And I tried thinking back, if my father-in-law had been a really proud fisherman and was serving fish for dinner, would I speak up and say, well, I don't think I'm going to eat any of the fish that you caught because it might hurt my baby? You know, that's a tough decision to make for a young woman. Whereas if the consumption advisories were generally known in the population, you know, everyone would know that a pregnant woman shouldn't be eating freshwater fish, except for those two species you mentioned, brook trout and landlocked salmon, and one meal a month, because those fish are fast growing, feed low on the food web, have limited mercury contamination, much lower than the slower growing warm water fish that you find in many of the lakes here in Maine.
It's not enough for pregnant women to know to protect themselves. We all need to be protecting pregnant women because that is our next generation. And it's a really important time, that brain development. And even the fish advisory says, even women who hope to become pregnant soon, you know, that's a good time to make sure you're not putting mercury in your body as well. I wonder if you could say something about the effects on neurodevelopment. What does that mean for a mom living in strong Maine?
Well, as an infant develops in the womb, there are critical points in development that can be disrupted by the presence of methylmercury, so that 1 week, the child would be especially susceptible to exposure to methylmercury, and the next week, maybe less so. So it's important that exposure to methylmercury be eliminated as much as possible during pregnancy, because that neurodevelopment of the fetus has been linked with changes in preschoolers' intelligence levels. Their IQ are slightly lower. Their developmental markers are a little bit delayed. Children are exposed to enough in this world. We want to eliminate any contaminant that we have control over. And mercury is one of them, because we know that the primary exposure route is through eating fish high in mercury. Not all fish are bad. Fish contain a lot of essential nutrients that are important for brain development. But you have to choose carefully and look for fish that are high in omega-3 fatty acids. And you can go on EPA's website. They list the fish that are high in omega-3 fatty acids and low in mercury.
I'll link to the chart from the show's website.
Right. And I think what would be really useful is if we could have public service announcements twice a year, right at the beginning of the ice fishing season, and then again when open water fishing starts. Just saying, hey, remember, when you go out fishing, you know, a lot of folks do catch and release, but the folks who want to eat their fish, remember that because of the mercury contamination, we women and young children should not be eating those fish that you catch here in the lakes in Maine. And this is not exclusive in Maine. There are mercury advisories all across the country. We are downwind of a lot of industrial activity in the Midwest and in southern Canada. And because of that, we have mercury coming down, which is why we need these federal regulations like the mercury and air toxic standards. And I really think this is an opportunity for people to write their representatives, say you support that.
If you're just joining this conversation, welcome. You're listening to What Mama Wants, Less Toxics and More Health. I'm Kate Manahan, and my guest today is research biologist, Dr. Diane Kopic. And we are talking about the element mercury. It's a heavy metal that acts as a neurotoxin when people and animals are exposed to it. And for decades, mercury contamination in Maine freshwater fish has denied members of the Penobscot Nation their legally protected sustenance fishing rights. And as with many toxic substances, there are social justice implications with pollution. I'm wondering what you're finding in your research. I know you're looking at mercury in fish, and how does that impact the communities around you?
Fish were not always contaminated with mercury. We used to be able to eat them freely. In fact, fish were a primary source of protein for the Penobscot, the Maliseet, the other Wabanaki tribes traditionally had fish as their primary protein source. And they would eat a fish meal or a shellfish meal almost daily. That's not possible these days because of mercury contamination. And to limit the cultural significance of consuming your traditional diet because of contamination, it really adds insult to injury in my mind. The Penobscot Nation and other Wabanaki people are looking to ways to continue that cultural tradition while minimizing their exposure to toxic contaminants. They are at the forefront of documenting mercury contamination in fish and shellfish and doing their best to minimize contamination of the lands where they have sustenance fishing rights.
So are they trying to identify exactly which fish are low in mercury so they can eat more of those and then the high ones, which they can avoid in their diet?
Well, the goal of some ongoing work being done by the Penobscot Nation with a grant from EPA is to identify different lakes that may have lower levels of mercury in certain fish species so they can share that information with their tribal members, allowing them to, if they want to fish for white perch or largemouth bass or some other fish, where they can go to minimize their exposure to mercury while still passing on the cultural tradition of fishing to the next generation.
It's quite strategic and possibly allows more of the traditional fishing, but they probably can't eat their traditional fish species.
No. And those two species I named are not native to Maine. So traditionally, they would eat quite a bit of Atlantic salmon, but those populations have to be restored before that's possible.
I see. In general, the bigger the fish, the more likely it has stores of mercury in its flesh. Is that correct?
Yes. Larger, older fish generally have higher mercury concentrations than younger, smaller fish. It also depends on where they feed in the food web. So fish that eat other fish tend to have higher levels of mercury rather than fish that eat plants or low in the food web.
If somebody finds out that they're high in mercury because they're twitching or having other experiences in their bodies, is there a way to get the mercury out of a body?
There is. I'm not as familiar with those methods. I'm really a wildlife biologist, but I know that there is chelation therapy that is possible. So you can work with your doctor on ways to reduce the load of mercury in your system. But that brings up another good point that women who are thinking of becoming pregnant should limit their fish consumption because it does take a while for the mercury to leave your body.
Yeah, it doesn't just naturally flush out the next week. You put it in, it falls out. It stays in your body for years, right?
It can. The fish especially retain mercury within their body for an extended period of time. So the half time of mercury in fish, which is the time it takes for half of the mercury a fish ingests on a given day to leave its body, is over 3 years. So if it's retaining mercury that long in its muscle tissue, which is what we eat, then it's going to build up over time. And that's why larger, older fish have higher mercury levels.
I think a lot of people get exposed to high levels of mercury through tuna fish and through sushi, which also has some large fish in it.
Yes. What's really counterintuitive is that albacore tuna, which is the whitest looking tuna, and you can see like flakes of muscle, you think would be better for you. But actually, tuna comes from larger, older fish that eat other fish because tuna are big, robust animals, and they have higher mercury levels in them. And it's the most expensive kind. And you actually find lower mercury concentrations in what's called light tuna, which is from younger fish and is actually less expensive. So the best fish to eat, which is high in omega-3 fatty acids, which are essential for heart health in adults and essential for brain development in a young child, are wild salmon, because they feed low on the food web. They're fast growing. They have all of the nutrients that fish pull together from the marine environment. And they have low mercury exposures.
Good to know. Making smart choices.
There you go.
So you mentioned earlier about some recovery we've been doing as a culture when we put in policies that protect us from exposures. Recovery success is something I'd love to talk about a little bit more. We don't really have to accept mercury pollution as a given. And if that's true, what can we do about mercury pollution to both fix the damage and prevent further exposures?
Well, our first step is to eliminate mercury emissions into the environment. And we can do that in our country by federal legislation. If people are aware of the ongoing problem of mercury contamination in our fish, and again, this is not just a problem here in Maine, this is a problem across our country. But by publicizing that ongoing contamination, making people aware of it, they can then act on federal legislation that is designed to reduce that pollution. Write our representatives and say, you support strengthening the MATS rule. We made mistakes in the past. We've recognized them. Now it's time to fix them. We need to take care of the issue here at home first, and then deal with the global problem with mercury. Because as I mentioned earlier, mercury can travel on the air up in the upper atmosphere for up to a year. So there are coal-fired power plants still being built in China that are going to be burning coal and releasing mercury into the environment. That's an issue. Another major source of global mercury contamination is what's called artisanal or small-scale mining. And that's where liquid mercury is mixed with ore that contains small amounts of gold. The mercury and the gold bind together, and then the mercury is burned off, sometimes in folks' cooking pots in their homes. And what's left are small amounts of gold, which are sold for money. This is an incredibly destructive way of mining, because it releases mercury into the home. It releases mercury into the nearby environment, so the fish get contaminated, and then the families are eating mercury-contaminated fish, which, again, is a neurotoxin. The UN Environmental Program estimates that over 2,000 tons of mercury are released a year just from artisanal mining, and this is concentrated in South America, Southeast Asia, Africa, generally developing countries where people are really desperate for a way to make a living. There are other ways for mining to occur that do not involve mercury. So we need both national legislation to reduce mercury emissions here at home. We need to be the shining example of what can be done to reduce mercury emissions. And then we need to support international programs to eliminate mercury emissions into the environment. And if we do that, we are going to find that mercury levels in our fish here in Maine are going to go down. And my goal is that by the time grandkids are fishing here in Maine, they can have more opportunity to eat the fish they catch. I remember doing that as a kid. It was a pretty sweet thing. I'd like to be able to do that again.
Yes, indeed. And we have done things like this before. When I was a teenager, there was a lot of talk about the ozone. And we don't talk a lot about the ozone because we outlawed the fluorocarbons. And now that hole closed up. And so good news, we can do something about it. And you're saying that if we stop putting mercury into the air and into the water, we will stop having fish with mercury and then we can eat them again.
Yes. Yes. And similar to the ozone, acid rain was a huge problem, especially here in the Northeast, where we have lakes surrounded by granite. The granite rocks were not able to neutralize the acidic rain that was falling from the sulfur pollution that was being emitted by cars. But we reduced the sulfur dioxide and other sources of acid rain into our air. And the acid rain is less of a problem now than it used to be. We can fix these problems, but we first have to identify them and make them publicly known. And then we have to act on ways to eliminate the contaminant.
It's where scientists are kind of heroes, but they're quiet heroes because then there also has to be the next step of communicating that and then the next step of policymaking. But it really starts with scientists. And I always respect the work you do because it makes a really big difference.
Oh, well, thank you. But I really think it's the community working together that achieves these goals, because you can develop information, but it has to result in policy changes for us to have progress.
Very true. Very true. It takes the whole village. What do you suspect Mama wants from us regarding mercury?
We should leave mercury in the earth. It is a part of the structure of our planet, but it has no biological function for any organism. It is of no value. So leave it in the rock.
Mama's like, don't touch that.
Yeah.
To close our interview, Diane, I'd like to ask you a few quick questions about your personal relationship with the earth, if I might.
Sure.
What did you like to do outside as a kid?
Oh, well, I was a pretty shy kid, and I spent my time in the woods with our neighbor's dog. I really liked cleaning up streams and seeing water flow through them and sparkle in the sunshine. And I grew up in the Midwest, which isn't known for its natural areas. There's been a lot of industrial and agricultural development there. But I just find our earth magical. And I went into biology because I wanted to be part of that magic. That's what biology is.
You are enchanted from such a young age. I love it.
Yes.
Can you describe a scene in nature where you have felt awe?
Oh, yes. I mean, so many times that I have lost my identity as a human and just become part of the natural world. I remember a few years ago, late December, we were out sampling ducks in Mendel Marsh. My partner from Inland Fisheries had gone out to scout another area, and I was sitting in the canoe fending off ice chunks that were coming in with the tide and kind of wondering what I was doing out there. You know, it was like 6 a.m. and was barely light. And I kind of looked up and it looked like there was a log on shore upright. And I'm staring at it and it's not moving and I'm not moving. I'm thinking, what in the world is that? And then I saw a little ear come out. I go, that's a river otter. And it was an adult river otter staring at me, trying to figure out what this crazy human was doing in a canoe in the middle of winter. And then the boat was jostled by a big chunk of ice brought in by the tide. I kind of shifted a little bit. And the otter said, oh, okay, this is a human. I'm getting out of here. And dropped down on all fours and loped off across the frozen marsh surface. It was the most magical thing. It's like we were talking. It was wonderful. what I really like is hearing wild animals breathing, just living their life. I did field work on harbor seals off the coast for my graduate work here at UMaine. And I remember sneaking up to a haul out site and listening to some gray seals who had hauled out. And they were just, you know, quietly talking with one another. And gray seals have kind of a musical way of communication. And it was like they were singing. It was just gorgeous. It's gorgeous. Yeah. And when you hear a sneeze, you know, a wild animal sneeze or, no, you're just part of the world.
What's one thing in nature that you wonder about lately?
Like a lot of people, I wonder about how our Earth is going to look after the effects of climate change really ramp up. I'm really concerned about the lack of water in areas where many millions of people are living, changes in the Arctic, loss of the permafrost, of the ice caps, about sea level rise. How are we going to support people on Earth, maintain enough habitats so that we can maintain the biodiversity of the other animals we share the planet with? It's a real worry. It's a real worry. And it's something that I first started hearing about climate change when I was in college back in the mid 70s. We never expected to be, at least I didn't, expected that the effects would be so profound in our lifetime. This was something that would happen 100 years from now, 150 years, there was time to deal with it. But now there's no more time to wait. You know, we're doing what we can individually, but gosh, we need all of society to act now. And we need leadership in our government and in the governments across the world to really address this. You know, we can buy EVs and we can put mini split heat pumps in our homes, but we need leadership so that everyone can do that.
And finally, what is your favorite baby animal?
Well, I'd have to say a harbor seal pup. I would. My first introduction to a harbor seal pup was when I was volunteering at a rehab center in California. And since it was my first day as a volunteer, I didn't know anything that needed to be done. So when a report came in of an abandoned seal pup, they said, oh, Diane, here, you take the pickup truck and you drive down the coast to get the seal. And I said, okay. And so I drove off 2 hours south of the rehab center and picked up a seal. It was in a, you know, small dog carrier. Someone else had brought the seal in from the beach. And seal was asleep. It all looked like a little pup. So I'm driving along, and all of a sudden I hear, ma, ma. And I look over, and it's the pup. That's their vocalization. It sounds like they're saying mom.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, my heart just melted. And then I worked on seals for the next 20 years. So,
Diane, you quietly work away as a research fellow collecting and crunching data to accurately monitor dangerous contaminants. And then you also apply what you've learned to protect wildlife and human health through better policies. Thank you so much for your thoughtful work on mercury in our fish and our environment. I'm so grateful to have you here on What Mama Wants today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.